The Beatles, Days in Their Lives.
The Days in Their Lives is an exclusive series using archives compiled over 25 years ago. In the last few weeks, we've heard from the people behind Beatlemania, the band's friends and family, and the Fab Four themselves. We've heard about the highs and the lows of being in the biggest band the world has ever seen. And now, the story continues. This is The Beatles, The Days in Their Lives.
The Beatles, Days in Their Lives on City Talk 105.9.
Last week on The Days in Their Lives, the Beatles had started working on various solo projects following the death of Brian Epstein. John's growing relationship with Yoko was taking him further away from the other three, and the Beatles' Apple label was having great success releasing other performers' material.
This is City Talk.
In November 1968, the so-called White Album was released on the Apple label. The two-record set was called simply The Beatles. Within a fortnight, it had reached number one in the Melody Maker album charts and stopped there for 10 weeks. Ira Libson picks up the story.
While in India with the Maharishi, there were stories about the guru's attempt to physically manifest his love for Mia Farrow. When the Beatles heard this, it solidified the doubts they were beginning to have about the Maharishi. When John wrote the song, it said, "Maharishi, what have you done? You've made a fool of everyone." But he changed it to "Sexy Sadie," which he later regretted. Paul plays piano and John plays guitar.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done? You made a fool of everyone. You made a fool of everyone. Sexy Sadie, oh, what have you done?
Paul wanted to write a song that would show him capable of rocking it up with the best of them, like Pete Townshend and the Rolling Stones. Unfortunately, some people chose to read things into the songs that didn't exist, which caused some serious repercussions.
Helter Skelter came about because I read in the Melody Maker that the Who, they were talking about a track they made. Now, I don't know what the track was because I never actually heard anything that sounded like the talk. Yeah. But the talk was the loudest, most raucous, rock and rolling, dirtiest thing we've ever done, man. I don't know what they were talking about. It would have been maybe an album track or something. Never caught up with the track. But that made me think, oh, gotta do it.
Yeah.
I really see that. And I totally got off on that one little sentence in the paper. I said, we've got to do the most loudest, most raucous, and that ended up as Helter Skelter.
Mal Evans plays some trumpet on the piece, and John blows sax. John says Revolution No. 9 was an unconscious picture of what I think will happen when it happens. It was just like drawing a revolution. I had about 30 tape loops going and fed them onto one basic track. I was getting classical tapes, going upstairs and chopping them up, making it backwards and things like that to get the sound effect. The ominous sound was completed by a mysterious voice repeating the phrase, "Number 9." It was actually taken from an EMI test tape, which said, "This is EMI test series number 9. John cut up the last two words and brought it in over and over for an eerie effect. And about all the mysterious messages and hidden meanings, John says, "There are many symbolic things about it, but it just happened." While fans the world over waited anxiously for Christmas Day so they could open and play the White Album, Paul was taking up with his new girlfriend, Linda Eastman, whom he had met at a London club called the Bag o' Nails, and later in New York when John and Paul opened Apple. Although she was a photographer whose work had appeared in several well-known magazines and on album covers, she took the pictures of them on the Let It Be album and the White Album, She is not an heiress to the Eastman Kodak fortune. Her father is from the legal team Eastman and Eastman, who Paul later wanted to manage the Beatles' business affairs. On December 6th, Apple releases the first album by James Taylor. Of all the new Apple discoveries, only James Taylor went on to bigger and better things, though it took a few years after he had left Apple.
City Talk.
John, meanwhile, staged another happening on December 18th in the Albert Hall, where he and Yoko appeared on stage writhing inside a large white bag. 2 days later, on December 20th, as the anticipation of opening the White Album grew to feverish proportions, the Beatles fan club sends out its Christmas record for 1968, with a cover designed by Julian Lennon, his father, and Ringo.
This is a big hi and a sincere Merry Christmas from yours truly, Ringo Starr.
Happy New Year, Happy Christmas, Happy Easter, Happy Autumn, Happy Michaelmas, everybody. Happy Christmas, everybody, to you. I'd like to wish everybody Happy Christmas this year of 1968, going on 69. Happy Christmas, Happy New Year, all the best to you from here. I'd like to wish everybody Happy Christmas, Happy New Year. From there to here, Happy New Year, Happy New Year, Happy New Year, Happy New Year.
Here we are again, another fab Christmas. Christmas time is here again. Ain't been round since last year. And we'd like to take this opportunity, all the way from America, to say Happy Christmas to you, our faithful, beloved fans all over the world who have made our life worth living.
City Talk.
The new year of 1969 is rung in with the release of the Yellow Submarine soundtrack album. The film had a lot of problems starting, not the least of which was the Beatles' disinterest in the project. They were suspicious because the arrangements were made by EMI and King Features, neither of which they entirely trusted. But when they saw the film coming together, they changed their minds because everyone involved had done a great job. It's a cartoon. The animation is excellent. The story is written by Eric Siegel, the man who wrote Love Story. An animator of Yellow Submarine, Tom Haley, gives us an insight to the production.
King Features came along with the script for the Yellow Submarine, and that came after two TV series of the Beatles. It was produced at TV cartoons in London. George Dunning's input here, I think, was responsible for really the outcome of the look of the Yellow Submarine, because he's quite a genius. The creative look of it, I'm sure, is inspired as much by the music as by Edelman's designs, as by us, the individuals, those of us who developed the and laid out the particular situations. I think the Yellow Submarine is unique. I think there have been pretenders and copiers who failed miserably because they did not understand the philosophy of the film or the philosophy of the design, the sort of graphic qualities, and certainly they would not have Edelman's superb sense of color. I think it is unique for its time, and I think it will always be unique. And the genius of it is that the Beatles music was both a catalyst for what happened, but also linked the whole film together.
Although the film had its world premiere on July 17th, it took EMI 6 months to decide whether to put out the four new songs on an EP, as the Beatles wanted, or if they could stretch it out to an LP with the inclusion of two older songs and George Martin's film score music. The first song was the title, Yellow Submarine, which we heard on Revolver. January of 1969 is not a happy time for the Beatles. They begin work on their ill-fated film, Let It Be, at Twickenham Studios. Paul thought that it was time for another tour or film, but the other Beatles had little enthusiasm for the project. John was especially apathetic. He was very involved with Yoko at the time and didn't really care what the group did. He just tagged along. John said it was a dreadful feeling in Twickenham, being filmed all the time. I just wanted them to go away. We'd be there at 8 in the morning. You couldn't make music at 8 in the morning in a strange place with people filming you and colored lights flashing. The best thing about the film Let It Be was that it was a fairly honest documentary of the way the Beatles worked and didn't work together at that period.
I know this one is like should play guitar through a tune. Well, I don't think you should.
Okay, well, I don't mind. I'll play, you know, whatever you want me to play. Or I won't play at all if you don't want me to play. No, whatever it is that pleases you, I'll do it.
We can start hearing the tapes now.
It showed the rough spots and the scars, the differences of opinion and the pressures involved in keeping the group together. But the greatest justification for the whole project comes at the end of the film, as the cameras document the last public performance of the Beatles as a group. It happened at noon on the 30th of January on the roof of the Apple Building at No. 3 Savile Row in the heart of London. Completely unannounced, the Beatles set up their equipment and begin to play to a shocked group of area workers. The producer of the film and head of Apple, Neil Aspinall, explains why they did it on the roof.
We did it on the roof here, and so we could set it up on the roof, and if it rained, then we could do it the next day or the next day, because there was no audience involved. The audience was going to be the people in the street, you know, because we put big speakers outside so they could all hear it and that, you know, and they just stopped.
While most people, young and old, loved it and jockeyed for better vantage points from which to see the event, several businessmen were affronted by the inconvenience to the working day. But there were few problems.
No complaints. There's a police station in Savile Row, just 20 yards down the road, you know. And as soon as there was 1,000 people stuck outside here, stopping all the traffic and things, you know, they automatically came and started sorting it out.
After that session, a few months passed, which see a lot more activity out of the studio than in. On February 4th, it's announced that the Beatles have hired Eastman & Eastman, the New York lawyers and Paul's future in-laws, to act as counsel to the Apple Corporation. 4 days later, it's reported that Alan Klein has been appointed by the Beatles to look into their business affairs. John says, we trust him as much as we trust any businessman.
I wanted to find out first if he realized the position he was. He indicated it. He had made a public statement about the financial problems that Apple had. And it was based upon this statement that I realized that he was aware of what I had been aware of. And so I called him and asked him if I could help, as general and as broad as that.
He offered to put their financial fracas in order and bring in new revenue. He was to get 20% of all money collected by Apple. Paul McCartney neither liked nor trusted him and tried to bring in John Eastman, but John Lennon didn't like this smooth, successful New York lawyer and persuaded Ringo and George to sign Klein on. Rumors of an impending breakup start, and John comments on the stories.
Because there was a lot of tension around the Alan Klein coming in days and all that, you know, and the ATV thing going on, you know. The Beatles were under a lot of pressure, and we had to be together all the time, fighting and arguing and listening to all these different business things. That business thing was like a heavy tour, you know.
City Talk 105.9. The Beatles. Days in their lives.
On March 12th, Paul McCartney marries Linda Eastman in London. On the same day, the tireless police track down another master criminal. They raid George Harrison's home in Esher and charge George and Patty with possession of the dreaded marijuana. And while Ringo is off filming The Magic Christian with Peter Sellers, John and Yoko fly from Paris to Gibraltar on March 20th and unite in matrimony. On March 26th, John and Yoko go to the Amsterdam Hilton and begin their bed-in for peace. John says, "Can you think of a better way to spend 7 days? It's the best idea we've had yet. We're doing a commercial for peace on the front page of the newspapers instead of a commercial for war."
First of all, we made people laugh, and that's good. You know, I mean, John and Yoko are like the wind. You can't see it, but when it passes, the trees bend. You know, and that's what we do. And they had a lot of results, apart from us getting a nice film out of it. and probably an album, a lot of people wrote us and sent word, and people from the States all around the world. And just instances like some guy wrote and said, now, because of your event in Amsterdam, I'm not joining the RAF, and I'm growing my hair. Now, all we were saying there, symbolically, instead of kicking a shop window in, say, do something like grow your hair for peace.
Well, it released the tension, first of all. You know, I'm sure many people had a good laugh out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's very important now, because there's very little laugh in the world, you know. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that we did something. We didn't preach or anything, you know. We just did something, a very modest thing, actually, you know, saying, well, this is the way we did it, you know. But that just sort of is to try to stimulate people to find their own ways, you know. And they can say, well, we can do it better. And then that's great, you know. And all we're trying to do is to sort of say, let's have courage and do whatever we can do. And let's find our way to do it.
And make love a lot more is, it might be a cliche and it might be fashionable, but it's still true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know they'll take me seriously. It takes some time to realise it, you know. And the first few days they were all saying, are you actually going to stay in bed for 7 days? What about coming to see the city, you know? And we said, no, we are going to stay in bed and this is what we're going to do. And in the end, they took us seriously. And we got all the light-hearted stuff over, and then by the end of it we were talking to Pravda and Czechoslovakia through the press, you know, and very seriously, and it was taken seriously all right.
On April 11th, Apple releases the Beatles' 19th single. Both titles were taken from the live rooftop sessions of January. They include a friend from their Hamburg days, a very popular American keyboard player and singer, Billy Preston, playing electric piano. The A-side came together quickly. Paul says, we were sitting around the studio and we made it up out of thin air. We started to write the words there, and then when we finished it, we recorded it. On May 9th, the Zappel record label releases two records. The first is from John and Yoko and is called Unfinished Music No. 2, Life with the Lions. Side 2 was recorded in November of 1968, around the time of Yoko's miscarriage. The cover picture is taken in London's Queen Charlotte Hospital after the miscarriage. The back cover is a great picture of John, proud and defiant as a horde of police corral John and Yoko into Marylebone Court. The other Zappel album was the second solo album by George, called Electronic Sounds. The first side was done at his Escher home in February 69, and the second side in California in November 68, helped out by American electronic music composer Bernie Krause. Something happened between them, so his name was quickly covered over in silver paint just before the release. Both sides are excursions into the world of electronic music, which the general public was not used to, so it left a lot of people scratching their heads. It was all done on his newly acquired Moog synthesizer, which was put to much better use on the Abbey Road album. These two records weren't the ones to set the world on its ear, but the label had been formed with good intentions. It was to be a label devoted to artistic endeavors and experimental sounds. Live performances of Lenny Bruce were scheduled for release, as well as a spoken word recording of Ken Kesey.
City Talk.
On May 5th, the newlywed John and Yoko buy a Georgian mansion in Ascot, complete with 72 acres and a £145,000 price tag. It is the house that the Beatles are pictured in front of on the Hey Jude album cover. On the 30th of May, the Beatles release their 20th single. The A-side comes in response to the increasing and unfair criticism that John was receiving for his political ideals, and particularly for his life with Yoko Ono. Bill Harry, John's friend from Liverpool.
John changed a lot when people denigrated and insulted Yoko Ono so much. he'd found someone who at last he could really open up regarding his art, because I could always felt from the art school days this tremendous talent wrapped up within him. Yoko was able to open up John's mind, to give him great amounts of space, and I think that it's like a symbiotic relationship. John and Yoko gave so much to each other, and that the people didn't understand that. They vilified her, and I think this drew him into himself a lot, you know? Because with Yoko, he found what he wanted, and people vilified him for it, which I think was wrong, because they didn't understand him.
John and Yoko give their impression of their critics.
Now and then we get depressed, you know. Like, if they end up, you have to just laugh at them, you know. There's nothing else to do. Because they're like sort of birds in a cage, you know. They've been in captivity so long, they don't know they're in a cage, you know. So you just feel sorry for them.
But being upset by them is almost like being upset by a tombstone, you know.
On the record, Paul helps John out on the vocal and plays drums, piano, and bass. The other Beatles are not present. The reference to Christ made many programmers of radio stations reluctant to play it.
Standing in the dockets of Hampton, trying to get to Holland or France. The man in the match says, you've got to go back. You know they didn't even give us a chance. Christ, you know it ain't easy. You know how hard it can be.
Beatles Days in Their Lives on City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. The Beatles Days in Their Lives.
On the 4th of July, Apple releases another single, this one by the Plastic Ono Band. It's a sincere statement from John, and while some people wrote him off as an idealist, you can hardly argue with his sentiment. It became an anthem for peace lovers around the world. It was recorded in Montreal in room 1742 of the Queen Elizabeth Hotel on a small tape deck by Canadian producer André Perry. It had a cast of friends including Timothy and Rosemary Leary, Tommy Smothers, Derek Taylor, self-styled fifth Beatle Murray the K, and members of the Canadian Radha Krishna Temple.
This is John and Yoko.
This is John and Yoko. No, you have to do it in unison.
Okay, one, two, three. This is John and John Yoko from the Peace Station, Montreal. Hi, folks. Peace, peace. Hi, hi.
Two, one, two, three, four.
The B-side, Remember Love, was written by Yoko.
Remember love, love is what it takes to see. Remember love, love is what it takes to me.
Meanwhile, back in London, Paul convinces George Martin to come back and produce a new album with the Beatles. He promises that it'll be like the old days again, and no bickering.
After Let It Be, I really thought that was the end of the road for all of us. I didn't really want to work with them anymore, because they were becoming unpleasant people, and to themselves as well as to other people. And I really thought we'd finished. And I was quite surprised when Paul rang up and said, look, you know, this is silly. What happened over Let It Be? Let's try and make a record like we used to. Would you come and produce it like you used to? And I said, well, I'll produce it like I used to if you let me. I can't do it otherwise. I can't do it without your cooperation. And he rounded up John and George and Ringo, and we started work on Abbey Road. And it really was very happy, very pleasant, and went frightfully well.
The sessions begin on the 8th of July and go until the 15th of August, although John's I Want You was recorded back in April. The front cover photograph was taken on a humid Monday, the 21st of July, just outside the Abbey Road studios in St. John's Wood, North London.
Paul walked barefoot across the road because Paul's idea of being different is to look almost straight, but just have his ear painted blue, you know, something a little subtle. We all were a bit like that. We used to go on stage with just, say, one polythene bag on one foot, and nobody might notice it, just us would be laughing. So for Paul, he decided to be barefoot that day, walking across the road. But when he first glanced at the album, it looked like the Four Beatles or whoever walking across fully dressed. But he just, that's his little gimmick, that's all. Yeah, I didn't even notice till I got the album. I didn't notice on the day he was barefoot. We were just wishing the photographer would hurry up, and it's getting too many people are hanging around. It's going to spoil the shot, and let's get out of here. We're meant to be recording, not posing for Beatle pictures, you know. That's all we were thinking. And I was muttering, come on, hurry up, now keep in step.
Just before the release of Abbey Road, John makes a trip to the Toronto Rock and Roll Revival. It was a last-minute arrangement, and when the rest of the Beatles couldn't come, John hastily put together a band consisting of Eric Clapton, Klaus Voormann, and Alan White. The concert was recorded and later released on Apple. On September 26th, the Beatles released their last recorded LP, Abbey Road. The songs are good, some of them excellent, and it's a fitting end to the life of the greatest pop group ever. Engineer Jeff Emmerich tells us of the Beatles' attitude at the time of the recording.
Well, that came together very quickly, within about 3 weeks, the whole thing. I think it was a question, because, as I said before, you know, that the unity wasn't there, that they just wanted to get it over with. It wasn't the same four people. I mean, in the days of Pepper, if Harrison was going to do a guitar solo, Paul and John would hang around, you know, maybe to help and give him some inspiration. When we're doing Abbey Road, they just go home and leave it all there.
The album opens with John's Come Together. It was originally intended as another peace song, but it didn't come out quite like he intended. It was later released as the B-side of the Something single. A lot of people consider the next song by George Harrison to be not only his finest composition, but also the best song of the album. He originally wrote it during the White Album sessions.
I wrote it as we were still recording that album, but I never finished it off. I could never think of words for it. And also because there was a James Taylor song called Something in the Way She Moves, which is the first line of that. And so then I thought of trying to change the words, but they were the words that came when I first wrote it. So in the end, I just left it as that and just called it Something. When I wrote it, I imagined somebody like Ray Charles doing it. It's, you know, that's how I, the feel I imagined, but because I'm not Ray Charles, then, you know, I'm sort of much more limited in what I can do. Then it came out like this. It's nice. It's probably the nicest melody tune that I've written.
He thought that it was too simple a song at first and left it for 6 months. Then he gave it to Joe Cocker to do. But before he had a chance to do it, George had revamped it and put it on Abbey Road. George says, it's probably got a range of 5 notes, which fits most singers' needs best. This, I suppose, is my most successful song with over 150 cover versions. My favorite version is the one by James Brown. That was excellent. John and Paul felt it was great, and both were pleased when it became the worldwide hit it certainly deserved. George's guitar break in the middle is probably one of his finest because of its taste and timing.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way now. No, I believe in how.
Ringo gets his chance at a vocal on this fantasy, which again uses the Moog synthesizer.
Octopus's Garden is Ringo's song. It's the second song Ringo wrote. And it's lovely. You know, it's again like Ringo. You get bored, you know, playing the drums, and at home he plays a bit of piano, but he only knows about 3 chords, and he knows about the same on guitar.
like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden in the shade.
The second song from George is every bit as good as the first. It came to George in Eric Clapton's backyard in the country. George says,
we had meetings and meetings and all this, you know, bankers and, you know, lawyers and all sorts of things and contracts and shirts. And it was really awful because it's not the sort of thing we enjoy. And one day I didn't come into the office. I just sort of, it was like sagging off school. And I went to a friend's house in the country. And it was just sunny, and it was all just the release of the tension that had been building up on me. And it was just really nice, sunny day. And I picked up the guitar, which was the first time I'd played the guitar for a couple of weeks because I'd been so busy. And the first thing that came out was that song. It just came. And I finished it later when I was on holiday in Sardinia.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right. Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun.
Paul has always had the reputation for writing the softer, sentimental pieces. But here, John proves that he can write just as beautifully. The Beatles again show off their great skill at performing impeccable harmonies.
It's three-part harmony. John, Paul, and George all sing it together. John wrote this tune. It's a bit like, the backing's a bit like Beethoven. And three-part harmony right throughout. It's just so simple, the lyrics are so simple. The harmony was pretty difficult to sing it. We, you know, had to really learn it.
Producer George Martin.
I mean, the three were terribly good at harmonizing anyway. And when we actually did the vocal backings, there was George and John and Paul singing as a trio. And well, I would give them lines to sing and then go up and record them and double track them. And in fact, I triple tracked the three of them. And it was just like working with a very experienced, very good professional group. And they took direction admirably. And amazing, really, when you think of their kind of arrogance, if you like. But they accepted, they knuckled down to that.
The song is about John and Yoko in their early days. Yoko was playing some of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, and John asked her to play it backwards. The piece developed from that.
City Talk 105.9. The Beatles. Days in their lives.
The second side consists of several short songs that weren't finished at the time. So they blended them all together to make one suite of the lot.
I asked Paul to think in classical terms, you know, to think in terms of writing a symphony, if you like, because that what the boys were doing was writing the equivalent of a symphony in today's standards. And I said, think in those terms and think of form and try and think of a song that you can introduce as a particular theme and then bring it back in a different key, maybe as a counterpoint to another song and weave it in and think in long terms. And Paul accepted all this and worked on the long one, which is the one side of Abbey Road, which is one long piece. And the guys saw the sense of it and they would bring in little bits. I mean, John would bring in a little ditty and say, have you got room for this anywhere? And can we slide this in somewhere? And they collaborated very well like that.
So as to not disrupt the flow, we'll hear the rest of the side now, starting with Paul's song written at the time of financial crisis at Apple. It related to the countless contracts floating around. As George says, we get bits of paper saying how much we've earned and what this is and that, but we never actually get it in pounds, shillings, and pence. George, John, and Paul harmonize nicely on the next piece, adapted from a poem about a former king of France, the Sun King, Louis XIV. George Martin plays organ, Paul harmonium, and Ringo is playing bongos. Mean Mr. Mustard is another Lennon song written in India. This goes right into another written by John in India, on which he uses a thick Liverpool accent because it was supposed to be about a mythical Liverpool scrubber dressed up in her jack boots and kilt. Next, we hear two songs by Paul. The first, She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, was written by him in New York while John and Paul were opening Apple. And Golden Slumbers, which he wrote while he was at his father's place in Cheshire.
My sister Ruth's piano book, she was learning piano, was up on the thing, you know, it was a stand, you know, it was a little book with all those words in it and stuff. So I was just flicking through it and I came to Golden Slumbers, you know. So I just started, because I can't read music, so I didn't know the tune. I can't remember the old tune, you know. So I started just playing my tune to it. And then I liked the words, so I just kept that, you know. And then it fitted with another bit of song I had, which is the verse in between it. So I just made that into a song. It just happened because I was reading her book.
Carry That Weight and The End finish off the suite with an excellent bit of rock. After 20 seconds of silence, Paul says goodbye with a funny little piece to Her Majesty.
I don't know, you know, I was in Scotland, and I was just writing this little tune. You know, I can never tell, like, how tunes come out. I just wrote it as a joke, you know.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I wanna tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.
The album has its rough spots, but it is a masterpiece of production with some beautiful songs, skilled instrumentation, and some great rock and roll. The title is perhaps the most fitting thing of all. It's the name of the studio on the street of the same name where the Beatles recorded virtually all of their records.
Abbey Road, for me, as always with all the albums, I like some of the tracks and I don't like others of the tracks. And it's always been the same. I've never been a knocked-out Beatles fan by any of our albums. You know, I like some of the work we do and some of it I don't.
Producer George Martin.
John got disenchanted with record production. He didn't really approve of what I'd done and what I was doing. He didn't like messing about, as he called it, and didn't like the pretentiousness, if you like, of record production. And I could see his point. He wanted good old-fashioned, plain, solid rock, and the hell with it. Let's blast the living daylights out. And or if it was a soft ballad, let's do it. You know, just the way it comes. And he wanted authenticity and that kind of thing. And he objected very much to what we did on Abbey Road on the second side, on the long side, which was almost entirely Paul and I working together with contributions from the others.
On October 24th, Apple releases a single by the Plastic Ono Band. The A side, with John's screaming vocal, Ringo's drums, Klaus Voormann's bass, and Eric Clapton's driving guitar, became for many the best post-Beatle record. It's a plaintive wail against the horrors of heroin addiction, or any addiction that affects human life. Even though it was anti-drug, the record was banned in a lot of places.
I offered Cold Turkey to the Beatles, but they weren't ready to record a single. So I did it as Plastic Ono. I don't care what it goes out as long as it goes out.
Disturbed by Russ Gibb, program coordinator for station WKNR in Detroit, who determines that Paul is dead, offering as proof a multitude of clues from album covers dating back to Sgt. Pepper. This sets off a flurry of playing record labels and sleeves for more clues. Paul insists that he is alive, but if he's alive, then how did he die?
No, it's a joke, isn't it? I mean, Paul isn't dead, you know, and if he was, we would have told you, you know. We'd be the first to know. I can't understand it, because I can understand the James Dean kind of, he still lives crippled but won't come out, you know. I mean, there's some kind of idea you could guess, well, maybe, maybe.
Yeah.
But Paul McCartney couldn't die without the world knowing it. The same as he couldn't get married without the world knowing it. It's impossible. He can't go on holiday without the world knowing it. How could he die without everybody knowing it? He's recording a group called the Ivies, but doing some background music for Ringo's film, The Magic Christian. It's just insanity, but it's great plug for Abbey Road.
This is City Talk.
On November 7th, John Ono Lennon and his wife Yoko Ono Lennon released their wedding album from the marriage in March. It comprised one side of John and Yoko enthusing their names to each other, Yoko, and one side from the Amsterdam bed-in. Are all honeymoons like this?
John! Yoko! John!
The elaborate album packaging took 8 months to complete. There was a replica of their marriage certificate, a postcard, some photographs, a reproduction of a slice of their wedding cake, a book of press clippings criticizing John and Yoko, and, of course, a record, side one of which you're hearing now. Side two was a sound collection of bits recorded at the honeymoon bedside. The whole package was a personal statement by John and Yoko, and, as with some of their other releases, was meant for the art gallery more than the general pop-oriented public. On November 23rd, John protests Britain's support of the U.S. war in Vietnam and Britain's policy in Biafra by sending back his MBE. Predictably, this drives the knife in even further for the people affronted by his having received it in the first place. Still, his ideals for peace can hardly be criticized.
Give peace a chance. Remember love. The only hope for any of us is peace. Violence begets violence. If you want to get peace, you can get it as soon as you like if we all pull together. You're all geniuses and you're all beautiful. You don't need anybody to tell you who you are or what you are. You are what you are. Get out there and get peace. Think peace, live peace, and breathe peace, and you'll get it as soon as you like, okay?
Then, on December 12th, Apple releases Live Peace in Toronto from the performance given on September 13th at Toronto's Rock and Roll Revival at Varsity Stadium. The songs were hastily prepared by the Plastic Ono Band on the plane over to the festival and include three rock and roll classics and three songs by John. The MC of the show was Kim Fowley. He gives them a sober introduction before John apologizes, then delves into his past with Carl Perkins' blue suede shoes.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Plastic Ono Band! Toronto welcomes the Plastic Ono Band. Toronto, Rower and Walker present the Plastic Ono Band. Give peace a chance. Give peace a chance.
Okay, we're just going to do numbers that we know, you know, because we've never played together before. And...
well, it's a 1 for the money, 2 for the show, 3 to get it ready. Now go, cat, go, don't step on my switch.
Backing John up are Alan White, Klaus Voormann, and Eric Clapton.
City Talk.
All through December, George Harrison tours with Delaney and Bonnie. They perform together in the War Is Over concert on the 15th with John and Yoko at the Lyceum Theatre in London. The year 1969 saw a lot of changes for the Beatles. An increasing divergence of musical and political directions, some albums from John and George which may continue to be largely misunderstood, 2 marriages, 1 arrest, increasing problems with the fact that the Beatles were becoming more of a business than a musical group. Then, at the end of the year, on December 19th, the release of the annual Beatle Christmas message. Produced by the Beatles and edited by Maurice Cole, it is their 7th specially recorded Christmas wish.
Now, you lads, will you just shout Happy Christmas for us at this stage? Hey,
Happy Christmas?
Yeah. Well, 1, 2, 3.
Happy Christmas.
Thank you, same to you. Happy Christmas.
Christmas down there, see that you're stirring, and ask a garden of
with your wife, Yoko, but do you have any special thoughts for Christmas?
Well, Yoko, it is Christmas, and my special thoughts, of course, tend towards eating.
All right, so eating. Well, what do you like to eat?
Well, I'd like some cornflakes prepared by Parisian hands. And I'd like it blessed by Hare Krishna mantra.
Yes, have a wonderful Christmas.
Have a jolly new year.
Make sure that Christmas
comes once a year.
Yes, happy new year.
All the best.
This is George Harrison saying happy Christmas, happy Christmas, Christmas, Christmas.
Garden here.
I think it's simply splendid. I'm overwhelmed by its sanctuary.
So, you don't mind this high gates and things, and the wall?
Well, I always loved high walls. The Elizabethan high wall is something I've always loved, you see.
Everybody listening to this has a very happy time at Christmas and has a good, fortunate, lucky new year, and a good time to be had by all.
Now, how do you see your place in the 70s to come? We've had the swinging 60s, and I was wondering, Mrs. Lennon, how you saw your place in the 70s?
I think it'll be a quiet, peaceful 70s, hopefully.
Do you think there's going to be peace, do you?
Yes, and freedom.
I see.
One, two, three.
The Beatles, Days in Their Lives.
Next time on the Days in Their Lives, John is threatened with prosecution under the Obscene Publications Act, Apple release Let It Be, Ringo releases his first solo single, and Paul officially leaves the band.
They do not want to split up, but the present rift seems to be part of their growing up. At the moment, they seem to cramp each other's styles. Paul has called a halt to the Beatles' activities.
The Beatles, Days in Their Lives. On City Talk 105.9.